Okay, so just a brief announcement before we start, or actually two of them. First of all, some people asked about whether it's possible to stay a little later and discuss things instead of jumping on the buses and running back to the South Coast Inn, and I was asked to remind you that if you're here a little bit later and if you call the South Coast Inn, they have a shuttle van that will come and pick people up from the ITP. So there's some facility for getting back later. The other thing is that it is free. If you're staying at the South Coast Inn, it's free. Or if you're traveling with someone who's staying at the South Coast Inn, it's free. The other announcement is that, also about money, for those of you who are getting some sort of financial reimbursement for the conference, the staff asks that you please check with them today to complete the paperwork so that we can get everything worked out. All right, thanks a lot.
Good morning, I'm Matt Chopturek. Welcome to the numerical relativity session. There's going to be a couple of shorter presentations in addition to the scheduled talk this morning, so if I cut Richard's discussion off at 10:20, it's not because we're not interested in what he says, it's just we want to fit in another couple of things. So our first speaker this morning is Richard Price, who got his PhD at Caltech in 1971, has been at the University of Utah in Salt Lake ever since. He's going to talk about colliding black holes, and he promises to be very controversial.
No promises. People seem to need to look at... Is it on? Seem to need to look at an overhead. So here is an overhead that indicates I'm going to make some introductory remarks. This will also indicate such to people looking at the web. I was very surprised to find out that my talk on black hole collisions would be in a session on numerical relativity, since I don't do numerical relativity. I, in fact, will give a much broader talk, although I will place the correct, I will place emphasis on the inevitable importance of numerical relativity. But it occurs to me that because I am not in the field of numerical relativity, I don't do numerical relativity, that may be an advantage as a spokesperson for the field in a number of ways, because it means I am not an advocate or proponent of one particular way of doing numerical relativity. It means I'm not a cheerleader or undertaker of numerical relativity. And besides giving me the viewpoint of an amateur interested outsider, it may give me some credibility. I will now move on to some more technical stuff. Again, this will indicate something to those using the web. Many groups have made important contributions to black hole collisions, and I can't even try to do a fair job of mentioning everyone. I'm going to try to some extent to mention almost no one, but there's got to be a skewing and an unfairness inherent in this. I will, however, mention my own work a little more, perhaps much more than it deserves, and I want you to understand that this is not ego so much as laziness, in that with the papers that I have my name on, I've already read those papers. I've read at least sections of all the papers. Due to the broad nature of this field, I also feel completely lacking in expertise in some of the technical details, and so I'm going to ask those in the audience who are experts in these details to help out with the answers to questions afterwards or even during the talk. When we think about black hole collisions, a good organizing principle for starting these thoughts is the equal mass limit of a black hole collision. A black hole collision, for the purposes of this talk, will be mostly the idea of an in-spiral ending up in a coalescence to form a single rotating black hole. A good organizing principle is to look at the two extreme mass ratios, equal mass black holes in-spiraling and colliding, and the test mass case, in which one black hole is much smaller than the other. The test particle will be denoted as having mass mu to distinguish it from the much more dominant mass black hole. An important point to realize is that the time scale for processes is the same in these two cases. For instance, in the early in-spiral, the time scale and the inverse of the time scale, the frequency, is given by the Keplerian formula, and is determined by the radius of separation of the two black holes and the mass of the space-time. At late times, the in-spiral goes into something that ends up in a process characterized by the final black hole. The time scale there is the time scale of the light travel time across the final black hole. And that is the mass of the space-time. So again, whether it is an equal mass case or the test particle case, we're going to have the same characteristic time scale, the same characteristic frequency of gravitational waves coming out. It is important to realize that because the frequency of a signal coming out is very important to to gravitational wave detection questions. Gravitational wave detectors tend to have a narrow band of maximum sensitivity. In the case of LIGO 1, the frequency of maximum sensitivity corresponds to a late in-spiral frequency of a black hole of about 100 solar masses, something that might be of interesting connection with the recently publicized possibility of middle-weight black holes. LIGO 3 with MMX is going to have sensitivity that is maximum at a slightly lower frequency, and therefore the black hole processes of maximum sensitivity will be more like 400 solar masses. LISA will have a much, much lower frequency of maximum sensitivity and be sensitive to much bigger black holes. But those sensitivities do not matter whether we're talking about equal mass or test particle case. Continuing in trying to develop understanding by comparing the equal mass case to the test particle case, let's look at a brief life of a coalescing black hole. Let's start by taking the test particle case, which is easy to do and which is can be essentially completely analyzed by using particle perturbation theory. The small particle is treated as a perturbation on the space-time of the large particle. Early in its life, there is a quasi-Newtonian in-spiral in which radiation reaction is brought in as a sort of post-processing. The radius of the orbit decreases. It gets to a radius of the minimum radius at which this quasi-Newtonian in-spiral can proceed. This is the famous innermost stable circular orbit, or amongst the people who think about such things more than they should, the ISCO. At the ISCO, the gradual in-spiral turns into some sort of rapid decrease in radius, some sort of plunge, some sort of merger scenario, and we end up with the final black hole. And the final black hole goes through what is called quasi-normal ringing. We analyze and understand quasi-normal ringing with black hole perturbation theory, and it is completely, in principle, it is completely understood, or whatever we don't know about it is something that can be solved pretty easily. So we understand essentially everything about this problem, with the possible exception of some of the details of the radiation reaction. We understand all three phases, and therefore it's good to move over to the equal mass case and see to what extent we understand that. The early stage of the equal mass case corresponds to the in-spiral. Radiation reaction is going to slowly drive the system in. We can use Newtonian ideas or quasi-Newtonian ideas, such as post-to-the-end Newtonian ideas, to understand that in-spiral. The latest stage of the equal mass in-spiral is that in which we have a perturbed black hole, which is radiating by quasi-normal ringing. We understand this phase from black hole perturbation theory. We understand this phase, although perhaps not as well as those building templates would like, through post-Newtonian theory. What about this phase, the phase in which we get from the early understood to the late understood? The mind, the human mind, even those of relativists, wants to understand new questions in terms of old concepts which are understood, like the ISCO, the innermost stable orbit. And so one asks, what is the ISCO? What is the innermost stable orbit for two equal mass black holes? But it's not clear that there's even any meaning to the ISCO, because we cannot ignore the radiation reaction as any kind of approximation, as you can in the case of the test particle. In the test particle, to first order in the ratio of the masses, there is no radiation reaction. Radiation reaction is a higher order calculation. And so it is perfectly consistent to look at this problem and in a natural way, by suppressing the post-processing that constitutes the radiation reaction, you can talk about stability. You cannot do this in this case because there is no natural way of turning off the radiation reaction. And so it's not obvious that there's any real meaning to the innermost stable orbit. Nevertheless, it's a useful concept to think of in terms of possible scenarios for the evolution. And it is a very important concept for those looking for gravitational wave signals because it is the concept that connects the early understood phase with the late understood phase. From the point of view of an experimentalist or someone with a gravitational wave antenna who wants to know what would be seen by a black hole coalescence, we understand the early quasi-Newtonian end spiral, a very periodic orbit slowly decaying in amplitude and actually increasing in amplitude, decreasing and increasing in frequency. And the end point is the quasi-normal ringing of the final hole. How do we get from here to here? Qualitatively, there are several different scenarios. It could be that there is just nothing corresponding conceptually to an ISCO. It could be that the two black holes rotate around each other, and then just with no qualitative discontinuity, they go into quasi-normal ringing of the final black hole. It could be that there is some discontinuity or some qualitative change in the waveform corresponding to what we would picture as a plunge of the two black holes into each other, followed by the quasi-normal ringing. The nature of this plunge might not be so important for the waveform associated with it as it is for the extent to which it excites the later quasi-normal ringing of the black hole. If we think about an ISCO or the whole process of plunge, the whole question of how we get from the early motion of the black holes around each other in a more or less intuitive fashion to the late stage, which is intuitive at least to those who've worked with quasi-normal ringing, the question of angular momentum comes up as a very important consideration in the possible scenarios. We know that for formation of a final black hole, we must be below the extreme Kerr limit, which means that the angular momentum that is going into the formation of the final black hole must be related to the mass of the black hole at most by 1. J over m squared must be less than 1. This raises the question of how the angular momentum is shed by the inspiraling black holes so that it is low enough to form a final black hole. A very important constraint or consideration in this is found in the writings of the ancients. Kip, back in 1980, completely analyzed, allegedly with no approximations, the correspondence between the energy being radiated in the wave zone and the angular momentum being radiated. These formulas must be applied in the appropriate asymptotic frame. Scholars have studied these writings. And have concluded from them the following constraint on the angular momentum contained in a multiple wave, or in a wave consisting of a series of multiples, a correspondence between the energy, delta m, radiated away, and the angular momentum, delta j. Within these formulas is contained the following relationship, or the following limit. It is clearly a limit, not an equality, because it's possible to radiate energy away in a way such that there is no angular momentum contained. But if you try to radiate as much angular momentum per energy as you can, this is the most you can do. The angular momentum radiated must be less than the energy radiated divided by the characteristic frequency at which that energy is radiated, multiplied by the multiple index corresponding to the azimuthal direction. We assume that the appropriate index is 2 because it would be L equals 2, M equals 2 that would dominate the radiation, perhaps. If this is very late stage radiation, then the frequency is going to be characterized by something of order 1 over m. If you put 1 over m in here and 2 here, you see that, and you set this to an equality, delta j equals delta m times m times 2, you see that it is just enough to maintain a value of j over m squared. So you cannot go into the latest stage, the stage at which the frequency is characteristically 1 over m, with angular momentum to m squared that exceeds this value. If you are to shed angular momentum, you have to do it at low frequency. You have to do it earlier in the process. And that brings us down to the question of when do you enter the late stage? Is it natural to assume that you will shed this angular momentum early enough so that you can form a black hole? Well, you could use Newtonian physics to get some ideas about the angular momentum to mass radiated away as you spiral down, because it follows easily from the fact that you're always in circular orbits. If you do the calculation of the value of j over m squared for two equal mass particles spiraling into each other, and just using Newtonian physics, you plot that against the separation of the two masses divided by the mass of the spacetime, this is the curve. And it isn't too frightening, because you plunge below the j over m squared equals 1 value. This is just the Newtonian value for two non-spinning curves. You plunge below this value at a separation, L over m, of 16. So if that that mutual orbiting holds true for a reasonable time, you would intuitively expect that you're going to shed enough angular momentum to form a final black hole under the angular momentum limit. But if those two black holes are extremal black holes with the maximum spin each, then this curve moves up to this red curve, and you cross this barrier at a very small L over M. And so you would have to believe that these Newtonian ideas hold until much later. One of the crucial questions, then, is how is angular momentum shed? And, in fact, are maximally rotating black holes going to hang up as they try to spiral into each other, because these little black holes know that they must get rid of that angular momentum. And if they're maximally spinning, they will not plunge into each other, because they know they have no opportunity later to get rid of the angular momentum. The only way, really, to understand the plunge is to do numerical relativity, to use supercomputers to find out what is happening, because we're in a region in which there are no simple approximations. Everything is of order 1. So what is numerical relativity as opposed to the black hole collision? There have been some remarkable successes of numerical relativity recently. I'm thinking, of course, of the work in critical phenomena, the work by Berger and colleagues in understanding cosmological singularities. But for this talk, numerical relativity is going to be confined to the black hole collision problem and the way in which numerical relativity is used for that problem. Numerical relativity is a two-step dance. You need initial data, and then you need to evolve that initial data. So let's first talk about the initial data. The initial data consists of the 3 geometry on some spatial hypersurface and the extrinsic curvature. The extrinsic curvature satisfies a simple subset of Einstein's equations called the momentum constraint, and the two together satisfy the Hamiltonian constraint. It is interesting to realize that once you've specified the initial data, since it is assumed that we're going to use vacuum general relativity as the theory of evolution, once you've specified the initial data, you've specified a spacetime. Of course, to find that spacetime, you have to use the evolution equations, the remainder of the set of Einstein's equations. You have to evolve that initial data and find what that spacetime is. But a good starting point for discussing the numerical relativity as applied to black hole collisions is what initial data we're going to use, because, again, that specifies the spacetime that you will find. In the context of a black hole collision, let's ask where in the life of an in-spiral we would specify the initial data. We could, for instance, specify the initial data when the in-spiraling black holes are at a very large, like 100 M separation, so that it's a quasi-Newtonian separation, and we understand what the relationship would be of the speed of these black holes and the separation between them. There is, of course, gravitational information, degrees of freedom contained in the gravitational field that are not contained in our simple statements about a Newtonian picture of two spiraling black holes. But any reasonable person would agree that at 100 M separation, the initial values, the initial value solution we use is going to be a reasonable approximation to astrophysical reality. So if we start with 100 M separation, the astrophysical plausibility, measured in some sociological sense by the number of arguments you would get from astrophysicists, is 100%. You wouldn't get many disagreements. As you go to smaller and smaller separation at which the initial data will be specified, you're going to find that it is less and less acceptable, less and less plausible. You could go to essentially a zero separation, a separation between the two throats, because it's even inappropriate to call them holes at that point, a separation so small that you are in, that those two throats are inside an all-encompassing horizon. In other words, you could specify initial data in which you're already in the ring down phase. Now, that would be pretty much a guess at what the initial data should be, and it would be astrophysically, at least in the general case, quite implausible. So as you go to smaller and smaller separation, you go to smaller and smaller astrophysical plausibility. How about computability? If you specify your initial data at a separation of 100 M, it is in the near term, and I'll be evasive about what near term means, it is completely uncomputable. The codes would not be able to evolve for such a long time. As you go to zero separation, in fact, there's an absolute guarantee of computability. You don't even need supercomputers. You could use something called the close limit approximation. The question is, where do these curves of computational plausibility, plausibility of computation in the near term, and astrophysical plausibility, astrophysical acceptability, where do they cross? It would be nice if someplace around the imagined ISCO we had about a 50% astrophysical acceptance rate and a 50% chance that in the next, say, 2 years, it would be computable. And that's an interesting way of thinking about the status of this problem right now. What initial data have been used for numerical evolution? What has been used in the past 20 years or so is mostly the initial data prescription given by Bowen and York. The details here aren't so important as the general idea that it's a the specification is that the three geometry be conformally flat. With that specification, it turns out that the momentum constraint can be decoupled from the Hamiltonian constraint. You can solve the momentum constraint without knowing what the three geometry is, and in fact you can superpose solutions for different momentum constraints. This allows you, it turns out, to superpose black holes at an arbitrary number of points in the conformally flat space with arbitrary momenta, or with symbols that look like momenta. They use P and it's a three vector, and with symbols that look like spin. In fact, when these holes are far enough from other holes, you can justify the identification of the P symbol as momentum and the J symbol as spin of the black hole. So it's an extraordinarily flexible and useful program for initial data. And it was crucial in the development of numerical relativity. But it has imperfections. And the imperfections are inherent in... Yeah, and I know that looks very cute, but it was an honest mistake. The imperfections are inherent in the very fundamental fact that the three geometry is required to be conformally flat. The reason that is an imperfection is that the Kerr geometry cannot be sliced in a conformally flat way, and in fact, a boosted Schwarzschild cannot be sliced in a conformally flat way. So what does this mean? Suppose you want to represent a black hole with the Bowen-York program. You would take a spinning single, suppose you want to, I forgot what I said, so I'll say it again and listen more carefully. suppose you want to represent a single spinning black hole in the Bowen-York program, then you would just specify the location and the spin. But it would not be a Kerr black hole, which would mean if you evolved that initial, those initial data, it would then relax to a Kerr black hole. And those calculations have been done with in something called the close limit approximation, and it has been found that a significant amount of radiation is released. Similarly, if you have a Bowen and York moving black hole, it would relax to a boosted Schwarzschild black hole if there's no spin. What does this mean as a practical issue? Suppose you were a numerical relativist and you wanted to start out your black holes at 50 M and you had solved problems in a way that we cannot even imagine now so that you could evolve from that separation of 50 M. What you would find as the wave signal from this system is the ring down at late time, as we know it must be, in spiral. God knows what you would find here for the plunge. But what you would find is an imperfection in that the earliest part of the waveform would be the relaxation of the individual holes to the black, to the stationary, quasi-stationary form, the Kerr black hole. This is no problem if you started a separation of 50 M, because you would be able to identify by location and time the difference between this relaxation radiation and the stuff you're really interested in. But it is not likely in the near future that one will be able to start from 50 M. One will have to start fairly close to the end point. And therefore, this relaxation radiation and the radiation of interest will be almost inextricably mixed. Another shortcoming imperfection of the Bowen-York program is that you cannot represent within this program the final black hole, and that causes technical problems for a very useful approximation called the close limit. What is going on and what interesting aspects are there of the initial value problem? Since 2 weeks ago there was a workshop in Golm on the initial value problem, I can very quickly report some things that are in the works. Jim York has a new formulation of the initial value problem inspired by the thin sandwich problem, in which it might be possible to make a better distinction between radiation contained in the initial data, what is and what isn't radiation. An interesting possibility for establishing initial values relatively late in the collapse is to use post-Newtonian theory to get you to a point at which you stop believing post-Newtonian theory and you have to switch over to numerical relativity. A relatively new approach used by two different groups with slightly different details is to use the Kerr-Schild form of the metric, which obviously isn't appropriate to the evolution, but to use it as an inspiration for the way of writing the initial data. There is the Caltech Mafia proposal, which is a speculation on how one might be able to very efficiently do the early evolution, in which the dynamics is largely the dynamics of just these particles rotating around each other, and one can sort of mod that out computationally. There is an initial data, convenient initial data sets have been proposed by the group at Penn State and at Utah, and in the Utah case, these have actually been evolved in the close limit to get some waveforms truly characteristic of a Kerr final black hole. One interesting aspect of initial value, one way of understanding the connection between the initial value imposed and the true initial value, initial values that should be used, that is the initial values that evolve from an earlier astrophysical configuration, is to use the test particle testbed. This is something that Carlos Luosto and I did. If you take a test particle and drop it into a Schwarzschild black hole, because of the relative ease of doing test particle calculations, you can find out a lot about initial data. What you can do is you can slice the space-time. What we have here is a trajectory of a particle released at about 15 times 2m, and this particle follows a geodesic and falls straight in. What you can do then is slice the space-time any place you want it and look at what the initial data would be on that slice. Because this is a test particle calculation and because gauge invariant measures exist, it doesn't really matter how you slice. That is, you slice on something which to zero order is a constant time slice, and you look at a quantity which is not sensitive to first order changes in that slice. So you're getting true physical information on what the initial, what the data is on this hypersurface. You can then compare those data with, say, the Bowen-York data, and you can see how far away the true data is from the Bowen-York data. And in fact, what is found is you get further as you go along. The true data is further and further from the simple conformally flat prescription, and that is not too difficult to come up with a better prescription. I want now to move to two what I consider interesting insights into the general question of black hole collisions and the general question of what is it that generates gravitational radiation. The first insight will have to do with the role of the horizon. And the starting point here is the close limit. In 1993, Larry Smarr was giving a talk on what I call the Smarr problem. It is the axisymmetric equal mass collision on a straight line of non-spinning black holes. In fact, the initial data correspond to a very particular solution of the initial value time symmetric problem. It's something called the Misner solution. He pointed out that yes, if you start with an initial separation divided by mass of the spacetime of 5 or so, then yes, you have something like two rather obviously distant and disjoint black holes. However, if you start at a separation divided by mass of 1/2, what you really have is these two throats constituting a single black hole. That is, these are well inside an all-encompassing horizon. And you don't really care, well, you care in some sense about what's going on here, but what's going on here cannot influence asymptotically flat infinity. All that can influence asymptotically flat infinity is that those is that aspect of the initial data lying outside the location of the horizon on that initial hypersurface. Therefore, this case is intuitively, clearly, a mild distortion outside the horizon of initial data for a single Schwarzschild black hole, it should be possible to use perturbation theory for a single Schwarzschild black hole and evolve this. That turned out to be a rather easy calculation to do. That calculation was done in 94. And let me explain the results to you. What we have here is the calculated radiation energy, energy and gravitational waves computed from this axisymmetric infall as a function of the initial separation of the colliding black holes. These points are the result of almost 20 years of numerical relativity. Those 20 years started in about 1976 when Larry Smarr did the first computation, the first black hole collision computations. They were redone in 93 by Aninos et al., where et al. Takes up the first half of the page of the paper. And we see that as the initial separation gets larger and larger, there is more and more radiation coming out, but there's a tendency to saturate at a rather small value of the mass of the system. Using this close limit approximation, the idea that you that when you start sufficiently close together, you're really evolving perturbations of a Schwarzschild black hole outside the horizon, using that idea, we come up with this curve. This curve is in remarkable agreement with the numerical relativity results up to a separation, an initial separation, it is surprisingly large. So one thing stored in the back of your mind is why should this idea of close initial data well inside an initial horizon work so well for large separations at which, in fact, the initial throats, the throats are not initially inside an all-encompassing horizon. Jorge would not forgive me if I failed to show how accurate this becomes if you do second-order perturbation theory. This is numerical relativity versus the kind of perturbation theory I just showed you and second-order perturbation theory. The results are so accurate as to be embarrassing and perhaps even misleading a bit. Why do I say misleading? There are possible pitfalls in the close limit approximation, and to see these pitfalls, let's go to... Oh, I'm sorry. Porky would also not forgive me if I didn't show this. Using the close limit idea, we can do a grazing collision. We can start with initial data corresponding to Bowen-York black holes, which are moving transversely to the direction of separation, so that you have something that you might imagine as the end point of mutual inspiral, at least if it happens in a rather symmetric and simple way. It's a close limit calculation. It has many shortcomings, and I know that John Friedman would like error bars on this, but I don't think the room is high enough to encompass those error bars, so let me rather tell you my intuitive feelings. I believe that that the result of this, which would be that if it were a rapidly spinning black hole that formed with J over m squared on order 1, we have a prediction of about 1% of the radiation coming out. I think that that is probably okay within a factor of 3 or so. I can't imagine that it's off by more than that based on experience with this kind of calculation. However, this is only the quasi-normal ringing. This is the late stage, if you like. This is the stage at which perturbation theory, at which the gravitational radiation emission can be thought of as coming from perturbations of the final black hole. There may be much more radiation coming from the early plunge, which then leads to a distorted black hole in quasi-normal ringing. The possible pitfalls of close limit and any other the close limit method, and maybe the lesson extends to any kind of simple approximation, is contained in this overhead. Suppose we take the toy particle model, and we start the particle from some position outside a real black hole and release it. It's in essence the small problem, not with equal mass black holes, but in the extreme mass limit. We can calculate the radiation emitted as a function of the proper distance to the black hole. Let's look to the horizon. Let's look at that. The true answers calculated from particle perturbation theory and compare them with the close limit calculations. It turns out the close limit method works only when the particle is extraordinarily close to the black hole. So close limit calculations, close limit approximation, the idea of the close limit method does not seem to work very well at all for the particle calculation. Why is that? The interpretation I give, it has to do with the role of the horizon in protecting complexity near the center. In the case of the equal mass collision, as those two throats get near each other, the complicated, highly known spherical processes between those two black holes is going to be kept from us. We won't know the ugly, twisted things that are happening because an all-encompassing horizon will form as they get close together. In the extreme mass ratio, the particle mass ratio, as that particle approaches the horizon doesn't move. So the particle can get very, very close to the horizon and still communicate to infinity, whereas that is impossible in the equal mass case. That tells us that in some sense, although it's in principle possible to do any calculation you want with the particle model, and it's very difficult to do the equal mass model, in some sense, it might not be as necessary to do these difficult calculations in the equal mass case because the horizon will protect us from the need to do those calculations. It also says that there might be more radiation associated with particle-type processes because the particle can get into a truly strong field regime before being cut off from infinity by a horizon. Let me turn now to a second possible insight about what it is that generates gravitational radiation. And this is something that fascinates me, although I'm not sure that it fascinates anyone else. It is the Abraham's cook recipe. The existence of cook and recipe in the title is just one of those happy coincidences. It is a calculation that was done in 94 and is not too hard to understand. Start with Newtonian physics and with the idea of two point particles at some separation L and at rest. You can then evolve that system without even a hand calculator, just with the back of an envelope and a piece and a crayon. You can evolve that system using Newtonian physics, and an evolution of that system means you're going to smaller separation and higher momentum. So you go smaller separation, higher momentum, smaller separation, higher momentum. The evolution, in fact, is a sequence of separation momenta pairs until you get to a point at which you begin to feel a little queasy and dishonest about using Newtonian physics. And you say, time to switch. You can then turn on your supercomputer and evolve the initial data that you have, that is, the information about L and P that you put into the Bowen-York program, for instance. You can evolve that with a computer, or in fact, you could evolve it using a close limit simple analytic calculation. And in fact, the first way this was done was with the close limit methods. It was then redone with a supercomputer. And these are the results. What I'm showing you now is, again, the radiation as a function of initial separation. This is the radiation per unit space-time mass. These are the numerical relativity points. This is the close limit. And here are the Abrahams and Cook results. They work for large separations, perhaps for larger separations than the computer was able to evolve. Why? And by the way, the work was subsequently investigated a little more deeply by Baker and Lee, and they found that the point, there was no great sensitivity to the point at which you went from Newtonian physics to numerical evolution or close limit. A fantastic agreement with the right, that is the numerical relativity answers. There's beginning to emerge some possible understanding of this process in the idea of momentum dominance of the initial data. What really generates, in some sense, gravitational radiation isn't so much the details of the 3 geometry, but is on a reasonable space-time slice, the extrinsic curvature. And all you need on that late-time slice is to have a reasonable value of the momentum so that you can put in a reasonable value of the extrinsic curvature. There is a lot of other circumstantial evidence for this idea of momentum dominance, but I will not go into that because it's time to talk about the core, the heart of numerical relativity as applied to rotating black holes. You might call it numerical revolution, evolution of rotating, spinning black holes. What are the issues here? One issue is variables. Which of the variables of gravitation theory do you evolve? Which ones have ddt on them so that ddt becomes becomes represented in a discrete way for evolution from one hypersurface to another hypersurface? And which variables are then computed on the new hypersurface from the evolved quantities? There are many different ways of doing this. The different formulations of general relativity, the different ways of writing the equation, are in some sense intuitively equivalent, although the very way that you write them makes some difference in rigorous mathematics for proofs of completeness and such. There is the choice of laps. That means the choice of the foliations that you're going to use of the space-time that you do evolve. Intuitively, we can see qualitative differences amongst the choices in this cartoon of the Schwarzschild geometry, Penrose-Carter diagram of the Schwarzschild geometry. If we were to draw these straight horizontal lines representing the foliations on which we're going to do the computing, then you see that what happens is after a certain evolution, we run into a singularity, and we understand the singularity, but the computer would not be so understanding. The numbers would blow up and the evolution would stop. We could also choose the laps so that we avoid the singularity, but we might also avoid any evolution toward the center. And by doing that, we could stop the things from happening that we want to happen, which will generate the interesting outgoing signals. So in some sense, what we want is a lapse which fits the space-time just right. And it is not clear, of course, until we know the space-time, how that is to be done. The technical way in which one specifies the lapse is either in a straightforward way by saying, for example, lapse equals one every place, is independent position, or by specifying a condition, a differential equation, which the lapse must satisfy. There is the shift. The shift tells you how much a spatial point is moved from orthogonal evolution off the hypersurface. And the shift will is in essence a diffeomorphism, is equivalent to a diffeomorphism on each hypersurface, and will change the values of the coordinate dependent quantities you're calculating, and so can be quite important. However, somehow philosophically it is considered not as fundamental to understanding the nature of the space-time as the lapse. There is the issue of boundary conditions. A boundary condition is needed, of course, at infinity, but that, at least in principle, is simple. We take everything to be outgoing at infinity because we want to look at evolution. What about the boundary condition at or near or by or inside the black hole? The first way in which numerical relativity was done since its birth in the mid-70s is in the following way. The initial data sets that were used constituted isometries. That is, the asymptotically flat universe we think of as ours was connected to an isometric universe through throats that represent the black holes. Because of this isometry, there is a minimum area throat in these, a minimum area location in these throats at which there is symmetry. The boundary conditions used in the earliest evolutions were that these throats, these minimum area positions, were spheres of symmetry. Because you started with initial data in which you had the isometry, evolution would produce always isometric universes, and you would always have this symmetry throat. So symmetry was used, and in about 1976, the first numerical relativity results were produced, which was the classic SMAR result, the SMAR problem, axisymmetric infall of Misner data. It is interesting that the initial separation is limited to be something like 8. Why? Because the codes, the evolution codes, go unstable if you try to run them too long. Of course, 8 isn't so bad. But this is an axisymmetric problem and therefore does not have the most interesting possibilities, the possibility of a lot of gravitational radiation generated by the highly asymmetric in-spiral. So, of course, there's been some more work on axisymmetric infall, but attention has gone to 3D. And in 3D, this instability and computer resources tends to be an enormous problem. As far as computer resources are concerned, let's remember that although there is some elegance in this idea of using symmetric boundary condition at the throat, there is also great inefficiency, especially as the throats get close together. You're wasting a lot of computer cycles on grid points that are well inside the event horizon. If you're going to do 3D as opposed to axisymmetry, you cannot afford such inefficiency. So it is necessary to use a boundary condition in which you don't compute where you don't need to. The right thing to do would be to cut off your computation at the event horizon, but the event horizon isn't defined on a hypersurface, so what is typically done is a location of an apparent horizon. If there's an apparent horizon, you know that there's an event horizon outside it. If you calculate from the apparent horizon outward, you know that you're calculating everything that can causally influence the external universe. But you're relying on the correct propagation of information. And that story, I'm not absolutely sure that there's unanimity of the psychological and sociological motivations for this, but this started people thinking about whether the problem, whether the right variables were being propagated. Because some of the propagation speeds in the partial differential equations that constituted the evolution schemes, some of the propagation speeds were not the speed of light. The Malthusiana conjecture for numerical relativity then became the idea that it was that hyperbolic formulations of general relativity were needed. And these hyperbolic formulations, all propagated variables, propagated at the speed of light. And quite a few of these formulations were done. This is just a reference in a recent paper on instabilities in hyperbolic formulations. It turned out that these hyperbolic formulations were in general, this is controversial, as unstable as the original non-hyperbolic formulation. And they required greater computer resources because there were more variables being propagated. So there is rumor, suspicion, feeling in the community that progress on true 3D numerical evolution of colliding black holes has kind of stalled. Let me suggest several possible explanations for this. It could be that the reason is physics. It could be that it's inherently not computable. The instability could mirror an instability in the underlying physics. If you try to do certain calculations in fluid dynamics involving the possibility of turbulent onset, you would find that your codes were always unstable because the physics underlying the differential equations is unstable. But this doesn't seem very plausible for a couple of reasons. First of all, there was no such problem in axisymmetry. And therefore, if it's a true physical instability, it has to be associated with the dimensionality. Secondly, the differential equations have a different character for general relativity than for fluid dynamics. In fluid dynamics, the propagation speeds depend on the solution. You can have you can have breaking waves, and you can't have such things in general relativity. It could be the math. Remember, most people doing numerical relativity are people who come from the relativity community, and they are very impressed by elegant math, and there is a tendency to want to find the right mathematical formulation, maybe a hyperbolic formulation, maybe some other clever way of moving the equations around so that they're highly computable. Whether it is something like that or whether it is something very different is very important for the question of the distribution of resources in the field. It could be that the problem is software. It could be that what is needed is just very careful, slow development of the modules that go into numerical evolution so that each chunk is very, very reliable. Convergence tests need to be done. The whole package needs to be carefully put together so that any person wanting to try out a particular idea can have a very reliable context in which to try that out. That would argue for proceeding very, very carefully and slowly with software engineering. The math viewpoint would say, no, don't bother developing any codes. We've got to figure out the right way of writing the equations. It could be, and I've written hardware, but what I really mean to say here is it could be that it's already been done. In a paper dating back about a year and a half, Bern Brugmann just said, never mind the fact that it can't be done, let me do it. And he evolved two black holes and produced noise. That is, he showed that in principle you can evolve for an interesting enough number of dynamical times that there's no fundamental reason that you can't do it. On the other hand, the numerical error was large enough that no one would take seriously the waveforms that come out. At GOLM now, they are geared up to the point where they either just have or just are about to do a grazing collision. And they can evolve for about something like 20 m. Again, what they mostly see is noise, not real waveforms. But it's a sign that what is needed is not so much new formulation as just more computer power. Very recently, the groups, the people at Texas, Penn State, Pitt, and perhaps another group is involved, have also evolved to black hole to a grazing collision of two black holes and gotten noise waveforms, but they weren't using a very big computer, and the possibility exists certainly to take that same program that they're using, do it on a bigger computer, get smaller errors, and that there's nothing in the way of doing this except bigger RAM, faster speeds, and a little more development. Thank you. Questions.
So when does the controversial part start?
All right. So first of all, some general questions. And let me get the mic before.
Well, if you had to guess what's the maximum amount of gravitational radiation which will come out from the sort of most favorable in spiral, based on what you know, what would you say?
50% plus or minus 50%.
The area theorem gives a fundamental upper limit, right?
That's no, I think the plunge is complete intellectual terra incognita.
So you don't believe these are, I mean, everything you said was like 1% or less, right?
1% from the final ring down. It's very difficult to believe that you can get, you see, but by definition, the final ring down is perturbation theory. But when you go from in-spiral to the perturbative last stage, you're going to go through a strong field region. That strong field region may be cut off by an event horizon from infinity and may not be very important. Or it could be the source of some the most interesting part of the wave signal. I guess if I really had to guess a little more seriously than my previous answer, I would say I'm not optimistic about a huge amount of radiation in the plunge.
Okay.
But it may very well be dependent on the spin of the two black holes. It's particularly interesting to think about extreme black holes rotating around each other and how they get rid of that angular momentum. It might be a very gradual in spiral, which necessarily is going to generate a lot of gravitational radiation.
Okay, take Kip first.
Well, following up on this question and answer, let me describe why I'm very skeptical that we know anything at all about how the how these systems are really going to behave in the real universe. If you have two black holes that have some significant spin, I'm not talking about extremal spin, but say an A over M of 0.5, say 0.7, and let's suppose that they are nearly parallel to each other initially, and that the orbital and that they're orthogonal to the orbital plane. We don't know whether that's reasonable to expect or not. But but in that case, you might think you're not going to have a lot of really interesting dynamics. Maybe, as you just said, it's going to sort of hang up for a while and go around and around and emit a lot more radiation. But sort of a quasi-sinusoidal sort. But there is this indication from post-Newtonian approximation. The only place where we know with confidence how the Carter constant evolves for the test particle limit, an indication that there is a tendency for the spin and the orbit to flip, so that if you have a orbit that's in that is inclined to the equatorial plane of a spinning black hole, the orbit tends to turn over due to radiation reaction. Now, that suggests that in the realistic case of more nearly equal masses and spins that are of some significant magnitude, even if you begin with the spins parallel to each other and perpendicular to the equatorial plane, there may be a tendency then for the spins to start to turn over. And in the really interesting period, you've got these spins precessing like mad, at some crazy angle to the equatorial plane as the stuff is trying to come together. And I think we have zero insight and knowledge as to what happens in that kind of a case, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if that's the generic case.
I wasn't aware of those results, but long suspected.
Well, there are no results, that's just speculation.
Oh, I'm sorry. What happens if there is spin flip or significant precession? What happens to the angular momentum?
Yeah,
where does it go?
If you wind up with some spin flip, then that angular momentum's got to go back into the orbital angular momentum, and the two black holes can start pulling apart again.
Okay.
I expect there's going to be a huge amount of feeding of angular momentum back and forth between the spins and the orbit in manners that we can only speculate about, and that we're so ignorant of it that I think we're likely to be missing the boat in all of the computations that have been done thus far.
Maybe relevant or opposite to that is calculations that have been done for the ISCO of a spinning particle around a Kerr black hole. These are done very recently by Suzuki and Maeda, and what they show is, first of all, as was already known, the ISCO goes to a smaller radius, or if you like, a higher frequency of gravitational wave as the hole is spun up, and quite interestingly goes to an even smaller radius or even higher frequency if the particle is a spinning particle. If these results go over to the equal mass case, it suggests that perhaps the smooth transition scenario is the one that applies, but it could also be the angular momentum back and forth instability that applies. This really is an area of incredible lack of knowledge.
Just a more general question. How do you know you're dealing with black holes rather than white holes? Perhaps it's a combination of the two. Another related question, you talk about the outgoing radiation. How do you know it's not incoming radiation? Or perhaps a combination of incoming and outgoing?
Or antimatter comets hitting white holes. or strings. it's the belief that what is going on here is something that evolved out of an astrophysical situation, and that the black holes were formed in supernova collapses or mass spillover in a binary. And so the past is all very simple, well-behaved. There could be some very exciting, exotic scenarios, but that isn't where the focus of this work is. I see.
How do you know that you are doing?
Do you mean how do you decide how what conditions on? You take an initial hypersurface and you put some conditions on that initial hypersurface, and then you evolve forward. Why not evolve backward, especially in the time symmetric situations? And the answer is that if you take something like the Misner problem, which is a time symmetric problem, you could evolve either way. Now, why do we say we're talking about the black hole problem? And what does it have to do with the black hole problem? It's astrophysically extremely implausible to have this time symmetric situation. And the idea underlying this is that the data that you specify on the initial hypersurface is supposed to be an approximation to what would have evolved in a very different way from what is truly time symmetric. That is, one believes that the robust contents of the outgoing gravitational wave signal are contained in the approximate specification on the initial hypersurface. It would be a white hole if you go backwards. But presumably, what really happened at earlier times had to do with microphysics that makes the scenario completely inapplicable.
I wonder if you and Matt and others could comment on this issue of that you alluded to of the hyperbolic formulations being as unstable as the non-hyperbolic formulations, which was not the party line a year ago. So something seems to have happened that I'm not familiar with, and I think people would be interested in hearing about a little more about that issue.
Let me make a comment, expand on it, and then ask Matt to comment, and maybe others would. The hyperbolic, there were what seemed to be generic instabilities found in hyperbolic, in the hyperbolic formulation, found first by Alcubierre. The actual experience with the hyperbolic formulation seemed to be that it was they were no more stable than were the original formulation, the ADM formulation. However, very recently, what would seem to be a minor change in one of the hyperbolic formulations done first by Baumgart and Shapiro, but then later found to be inherent in the formulation of Bona and Massot, and perhaps in other hyperbolic formulations. And with this change or choice, it turns out that you have stability. You seem to have pretty good long-term stability, and at the same time, significantly decreased accuracy. This is too new for these statements to be reliable. But an interesting possible decreased accuracy, increased stability. Let me give you a... Well...
That's easy to do.
That's right, dude. Yeah, it depends on your tolerance for low accuracy.
Well, I can make my codes perfectly stable.
Right. in this case, it is believed that there is some signal left in the truncation error. There's an interesting possible explanation, although it isn't a complete explanation, that's been offered by the group at GOM, and it's the following. The change, one of the changes that is necessary is a change in speed of some gauge noise. So, and what was causing the instability was
the speed of propagation,
yeah. And I know this seems to be, whatever. If one makes a certain choice of the way the equations are evolved, then you do not get this error propagating at all. It's an elliptical equation. It just builds up and causes the code to go unstable. You can make a but it doesn't cause errors in the outgoing radiation because it's all in the central region, the high curvature region. If you reformulate the equations in a certain way, then what happens is this noise propagates outward and therefore does not build up and cause an instability. But at the same time, it appears in the outgoing radiation and could be the reason that the accuracy is lower. This cannot be a complete explanation because this change is not the only change that is needed in order to get the stability. So an interesting development, but not completely understood. And now I think Matt should give perhaps a different view. Matt?
Well, actually, I'm going to pass it over to Luis Lehner, who is sitting here waiting for you to finish, and will give somewhat of a dissenting view, I think.
I just wanted to comment on what you said about this method by Van Garde and Shapiro. Well, it's actually a revision of the Nakamura and Shibata method.
That's right.
And they indeed found very nice behavior when they were evolving linear waves. But when they started trying black holes, and we've also tried that, it also exhibits the same kind of instabilities that a non-well-posed formulation would show in the K dot G dot equations. One of the problems that appear to play an important role is that, yes, well-posed systems are great, but not until recently people have paid attention to the boundaries, which effect do the boundaries pose in the problem. John Stewart have recently put a paper out there where he shows that if you want to do an initial value boundary problem in a well-posed way, then you have to enforce some things in the boundary that nobody has ever been trying that. Also, there is a paper by Helmut Friedrich and Gabriel Nagy, and they also show that in their formulation, in Helmut's formulation, you can indeed achieve that. So it's not a matter of just using a well-posed formulation, but also paying close attention to what the boundaries are doing.
Could I check on some factual information? At GOM, I was told that the code was running stably, although of low accuracy, for black holes.
I'm not sure of that. What I've seen is these formulations being run for black holes, and they also exhibit these weird behaviors. There is a place where you could put the outer boundary where it is stable. Now you move it farther out a bit, and then you start seeing instabilities.
I think Matt.
I think your general statement concerning the stability of hyperbolic evolution is not quite correct. You compare a certain class of calculations. But if you look at the calculations of Peter Hübner, he is calculating space-time right out to null infinity, and it keeps going and going. He does not observe in his calculation any stability at all. I mean, it just slows down because in the calculations he did, there is a singularity sitting in the future which opened up the light cone, so it has to slow down, and unless you do something special, you can't approach it. But he did not have any problems at all. And I think it's also associated with the boundary problem. There is no artificial boundary. Everything goes out to null infinity. So I think this shows that maybe one should put the emphasis a little bit more on the math side. You said, what do we need, math or physics? We heard the physics is not clear at all. I think we have to discover the physics from the math in this particular situation. And I think that's, I think, where the effort should be put.
I just wanted to make the clarification that the Baumgart-Shapiro, it isn't a hyperbolic formulation.
I thought it was a modification of a hyperbolic formulation.
I was not going to talk about hyperbolic formulations.
Regarding your question?
Well, so if I can change your topic a little, I wanted to comment on your hopeful assumption that the binary black hole problem might have been done already. It could be solved immediately if we had just big enough computers. Mm-hmm. So I disagree with that. I think some problems could be solved, like the outer boundary could clearly be solved if we had an infinitely large computer. And perhaps the stability problems could be beaten down by just having a smaller time step and so on. But there's two problems that really have not been solved for the binary black hole problem. One of them is a technical problem in the black hole excision, how to impose numerical boundary conditions at the black hole excision. You need to excise black holes if you want to get several orbital periods. And the other thing is we don't know what coordinates to use. And so I think the Brugmann calculation is stopped short after a fraction of a revolution by either of those two problems. And so I think those are one mathematical and one technical problem that need to be solved before we can even think of getting the grazing collision beyond a fraction of an orbit.
That's not going to comment. Let me say the following. Shorter time steps seem to increase the instability rather than decrease the instability. And there's probably something interesting going on there. Secondly, it is the boundary values, the boundaries that have been used in the examples that I cited have been so close as to be ridiculous. The inaccuracy could very well be associated with those close boundaries. With more computer power, with those boundaries moved out, what I was suggesting is the possibility that when those boundaries are moved out, things start to make sense.
Yeah, I agree. The other things that you did not mention, those that I just said.
You mean details that need to be solved?
Yes, black hole excision and three-dimensional coordinate
conditions. But what I'm saying is the codes have already been run in which those problems have been dealt with.
Here I have to agree with Karsten. I don't think there's any code that has anything close to an acceptable coordinate condition for the end spiral, or a demonstration that you can run three-dimensional calculations with black hole excisions for long times. In fact, there's no, apart from spherical symmetry, there are no long-term evolutions with excision.
Let's not talk about true end spiral, but a grazing collision leading to a final black hole.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is if you don't have excision, you're going to develop a coordinate singularity on a dynamical time, and your code will blow up. Mm-hmm. So, and if you're going to be happy with a grazing collision followed by a black hole that blows up, then maybe you can do that right now, but that's certainly not what we're after in the two-black hole collision problem. Mm-hmm. We want to have the black holes represented as reasonable astrophysical objects, the way that we think that they should behave to the external world.
I would say that the controversy here is whether one should proceed by a careful development of the tools that are viewed as necessary for doing the astrophysically interesting problem, as opposed to getting something working for a late stage of something that is interestingly related to the astrophysical problem, and using that as a point of polishing and honing and developing the final code.
Yeah, but
two very different approaches.
Well, one of the whole motivation, though, behind black hole excision is if you just take a historical view and go back and you look at the time lag between SMARS calculations and the current calculations of something approaching, what is it now, 25 years or more, with the attendant
orders of magnitude increase in computational power, you still measure the lifetime of an evolution in several m, or 20 m, or 30 m, or 40 m. An astrophysicist who's modeling a star would find that a completely ludicrous situation. His star or her star sits there, and if it's not unstable, it sits there and sits there and sits there, you know, for an unbounded amount of time. And it just seemed to a lot of us, and I think that the community generally agrees now, that without excision, realistic black hole simulations just aren't possible. And after Carsten's talk, some of these Yang-Mill collapse calculations, I think you can see that, you know, the qualitative difference that comes with the excision techniques.
So with a larger number of black holes, the area theorem says you can have increased radiation. So my question is, have there been any modelings of large numbers of black holes, but perhaps in a highly symmetrical situation, so that you could, with the symmetry, maybe you have them all spiraling around the same direction, maybe you make the calculation plausible. So has anything like that been done?
Matt, do you know?
No, I don't think anything like that's been attempted.
What do people usually do with a Hamiltonian constraint now? Is it solved elliptically each step, or do they use it as a way of checking accuracy?
Almost all the current codes are, in fact, all the codes, as far as I know of, are free evolution. So they're not enforcing the constraints explicitly, except at the initial time. And again, in lower dimensional calculations, we've always found that it's easier to get things running stably if you explicitly enforce the constraints. So in my mind, there's still the potential that some form of constrained evolution may help a lot here.
So why don't they?
Well, because elliptic equations are relatively difficult to solve from an efficiency point of view and also from a coding point of view. So if you took the cactus code, the current Potsdam code that does parallelization and does a beautiful job of it, it really would bind down if you tried to solve elliptic equations with it. And then you'd end, I think with the, actually there were 2D calculations that were done that were fully constrained, and those were the codes that were based in Cornell, and a very large fraction of the time is spent in elliptic solvers. So it's essentially efficiency concerns, coding concerns, and also when it comes to excision, there's the question of what kind of boundary conditions you're going to place on the inner throats for the elliptics.
I think you're right.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to... No, we've got time. I just wanted to have it queued up so we could go.
Two questions. One was for Helmut and one was for you. For Helmut, I mean, has this code, that Peter Hubner score that you referred to, has it really done anything with colliding black holes? Sure. No, I'm just asking for this. Just evolved. The question for you is, early in your talk, you sort of talked about Born-York data, and you said, well, of course, you can't get Kerr's black hole or a boosted Schwarzschild black hole in that data. But then you had some remark about, however, you can start with just one initial data for one black hole, and then it relaxes into Kerr or relax. I don't understand the sense in which this is true, so maybe you can amplify. My question is basically that the initial data is different from Kerr, right? And then I evolve. Then is a statement about slicing, that is, on some slices it looks like Kerr again, or what is the statement?
The Bowen-York initial data could be said to be a rotating black hole with initial perturbations of long wavelength. And so if you turn on an evolution code, it will then radiate away its distortions from Kerr, its perturbations away from Kerr, and relax into the only stationary state available.
Right. So the statement is that on the grid that is available, that is left over, then it looks like Kerr on that space. In the whole space-time, doesn't look like Kerr, but
it looks like a Kerr black hole with outgoing radiation.
Okay, any more quick questions? All right, it's for discussion. Okay, I've asked Luis Lehner just to show a little bit of his results. He's going to be talking later on this week, but I thought it would be interesting for us to see some of the stuff earlier on.
Well, before I show that, I wanted to talk with Richard about, he said he would give a controversial talk, and probably you were referring to the stalling of numerical relativity, and I disagree with that. I think all the easy problems are already done, and now we're fighting.
Well, this was D, where I said that all that is needed is a bigger computer.
Yeah, I'm not going to be talking about this, but you see all the things that have been coming out of numerical relativity. On one hand, you have the critical phenomena problem. So all the many solutions have been found in 1D, and now they are taking that into 2D, and you know that's going to be extremely hard. And that's why you don't see as many results coming out as they were in the past. Also, in the case of black hole collisions, all the easy problems, let's say all the collision in axisymmetric problems, are already done, and that was done in a few years.
I would argue about that.
Well, yeah, that problem was much simpler. Then we went into 3D, and now we're facing much tougher problems. So I don't think the field has stalled, but rather the results are going to be coming in a much slower pace, but we're working hard on that.
I was thinking that there is a perception in the community that the effort has stalled, and perhaps this perception is clearest in a bet between Kip and the numerical relativity community.
On the other hand, we don't like to lose a bet. I hate to lose a bet, and I'm in that bet with Keith, and I have another one with Matt. I was smarter in Matt's bet because I have 4 more years with him. So just this part of the talk that I'm going to give on Saturday, but many of you won't be here because you will be going to Japan, and since this fits nicely with Richard's talk, I'm going to be showing something of this. This is just a comment about what he talked about, this collision of two gazing black holes. So what we have is initially two Kerr black holes that have momentum, both have 0.5 momentum in the z direction. They both have mass equal 1, and we just boost them towards each other. So it's a gazing collision of two single holes. We use these excision techniques in order to excise singularity and avoid having to evolve the fields inside those balls you see there. And just we just let them evolve using the ADM standard equations. And we use this apparent horizon finder that basically tracks where the holes are and excise the region inside the holes. So what I'm showing in this point here. So here is the configuration you have at the initial time slice. So at a later time, let's say you have something like this. This is actually two holes, not a single hole. I'm just showing an intermediate output that the apparent horizon finder produces, because then this basically starts going down and it will show two separate regions. But I'm showing this because, well, and the later, but it really finds something like this where the holes are just closer. So I'll show you a simulation of what actually gave us, but before going to that, let me tell you what our current efforts are. One is trying to set up a correct initial data. As Richard said, we're using the Bowen and York formulation, except that instead of saying that the three metric is conformally flat, it's conformally related to a Kerr shift kind of metric, so we won't have the problem of not being able to reproduce Kerr holes. We're working in using the so-called Cauchy characteristic matching in order to provide boundary data and also to get the waveforms from that simulation. And we are working hard in understanding coordinate conditions and addressing computer science issues like parallelization and visualization. So at a later time, this old 4M, this apparent horizon finder actually finds a single hole. So what you see is that inside that region is where the two singularities are. So we excise everything that is inside this region and just evolve the figure. And at a later time, you just have that and it looks closer and closer to a more spherical shape. So let me run the simulation for you. So this is It's real time calculation. And we actually produced these results last week, so there's still a lot to polish here. So initially we have this configuration. This is a cut at the C=0 plane. Then we have one hole there, and the region inside it's being excised, so we just set the field values to zero. Oh, here, sorry, this is the G exact component metric. So you see the holes slowly come towards each other, and when we find a single apparent horizon, we just excise that from the computational domain. And at the end of the calculation, you start seeing some boundary effect that we'll be able to solve once we have better resolution and we can put the whole matching in there to produce boundary data. Let me show this again. And again, you see how when they get to be close to each other, there is a single hole we excise, and you can actually see how the things start spinning, and that's the angular momentum that was induced by this crazy collision of two holes.
How much of the dynamic boundary do you actually calculate? I mean, do you go far into the future, or just expansion? I mean, this is the transition zone, the dynamic transition.
The transition of what?
No,
there's no matching here. There's no matching here. That's why we see these spikes at the end of the simulation. And just to show you the noise that Richard was referring to, this is one of the components of the waveform. So we just see a first initial burst, then it goes to zero, and then at the very end of the simulation, we start seeing the second burst, which may or may not be some ring down, or what will probably be is just noise. But with more resolution that we can do, we now have a code that is completely parallel. It uses part of this cactus code that was developed in Boston, but we have our own drivers to evolve the evolution equations. We can go into a parallel machine and have a run like that with a much better resolution.
These transparencies will address some of the effects of the gauge variables that came up earlier with the hyperbolic code. So I tested two first-order hyperbolic formulations of the Einstein equations on a one-dimensional nonlinear plane wave using a code which I reset the RAPS function at the beginning of every time step. And this work is done with my advisor, Professor Jim Bardeen. And so the two codes that I'm talking about are these two codes here. One is based on the Bonamassa formalism, and the other one is the Anderson-York formalism that just came out very recently in January of 1999. So both of the codes that we used express the Laplace function in this algebraic relation with the spatial metric. So this is the expression for the Laplace function in both of the codes. And H here is the determinant of the spatial metric. So the difference in the two codes is how the momentum constraint is implemented. And in the Bonamassa code, it separates out these two variables, this V, I, and this D, K, I, J. And then the momentum constraint is applied to V, I, and you get this evolution equation for V and the source term in the Bonamassa code. And in the Anderson-York formulation, this V and D are not separated out, so you just have one variable, this F, K, I, J, and the momentum constraint is applied to that to obtain an evolution equation for the F variable. So the result of the different implementations of the momentum constraint is that you get different evolution equations for these gauge variables DZZZ and FZZZ. And also just to note that the D variable is the derivative of the spatial metric. So you can see here that the evolution equation for this DZZZ, which is in the nonlinear plane wave case, does not have any source term, but for the FZZZ, you do have a source term. And then the other, these other gauge variables, this KZZ, the extrinsic curvature variable, in their flux terms, they have these variables that were affected by the implementation of the momentum constraint. So I coded up these two codes, and they're both second-order accurate in all of the variables, including the gauge variables, and they satisfy the momentum and energy constraints throughout the numerical evolution. Basically, it was to t equals 10 until, you know, went through the boundaries on the side of the grid. The physical wave propagates in a simple propagation accurately. There's not any problem with the physical waves. However, we do see these small gauge effects with these variables, the DZZZ, KZZ, and in the Anderson-York case, the FZZ and KZZ. So that's what I wanted to show you today. Okay, so I'll put over here, this is a very high resolution result for, now this is KZZ and FZZZ. I'll concentrate on KZZ since that variable I can compare in both of the codes since they're the same variable. And this gives a very high resolution result, 4,000 points, a shift of 0.8. And so you can see that's for the Anderson-York code, and you can see that for the Bonamassa code, at the high resolution, if I can get these overlaid, they're exactly the same. So they match precisely at the very high resolution, or not precisely, but very close. Now, it's important also to look at the very coarse grid, since when we want to go to two dimensions or three dimensions, you don't want to be solving it on 4,000-point grid. You want a much coarser grid. So so if we looked at the coarse grid of 250 points and compared the two codes, then we can start to see where some of the problems are occurring. So this is the Anderson-York code on the coarse grid, and you can see that the shape of the wave is maintained quite well, but it does lose accuracy in this right-hand portion of the wave. The scale on here is 2 times 10 to the minus 5th, whereas on high resolution, it's 1 times 10 to the minus 5th. So it does lose accuracy on the right-hand side of the wave. And the Bonamassa code does not maintain the shape of the wave. If I try to overlay this, then you can see that in the right-hand part of the wave, the wave has gotten out of phase with the high resolution result. And in the left-hand part of the wave, it also loses accuracy. So this just is to show you, you know, these gauge effects that came up in Richard Price's discussion. And it looks like the York is better, slightly better in maintaining the wave shape. However, they both have problems in maintaining the accuracy. Thank you.
Okay. You might all speak, please, not any transparency.